Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, September 12, 2010, here in WILL, AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is someone we've had on the show before, one of my favorite guests to have on the show. In the book I wrote with John Nichols that came out earlier this year, we wrote that if the only thing the internet had given us was Glenn Greenwald's journalism, it would make the invention of the internet worthwhile. So it's our pleasure today to welcome the subject of that praise, Glenn Greenwald, the Salon.com blogger and author. He'll be joining us for the full hour from his home in Brazil. It's going to be a great show. Stay tuned and join us, but first let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Legislation for a federal shield law, which would protect reporters and their sources against being forced to disclose confidential information, has picked up steam recently, but with a twist. Senators Charles Schumer of New York and Dianne Feinstein of California are working with representatives of the newspaper industry to craft new language for an amendment to the bill that will explicitly exclude organizations like WikiLeaks. This new push comes on the heels of WikiLeaks' decision to post nearly 77,000 classified Afghanistan war records obtained through anonymous sources. Douglas Lee, an Illinois attorney and a legal correspondent for the Freedom Forum First Amendment Center, says that in joining forces with legislators to exclude WikiLeaks from protection, journalists are endangering the independence they're striving to create.
In general, it doesn't strike me that media companies, media organizations should be in the business of limiting protection for those folks who disseminate information.
The current draft of the bill defines a covered person as someone who works, quote, with the primary intent to investigate events and procure material in order to disseminate to the public news or information, unquote. But the proposed amendment to the bill will most likely include language about the covered person having editorial oversight, going through channels of consultation before publishing sensitive material.
You've got media organizations, you know, trying to distinguish WikiLeaks away, saying, well, they don't have editorial oversight. Well, I mean, the facts are that there were 92,000 documents, and WikiLeaks released 77,000 and withheld 15,000 based on something, based on WikiLeaks' view that it wasn't appropriate on using whatever standard to release those documents at this time. Well, if that's not editorial oversight, if that's not enough editorial oversight to qualify for protection for the Act, what is?
If you have a standard set forth in law that judges will have to interpret, editors will have to testify about their motives and their process.
That will then be on a very slippery slope in determining how much editorial oversight is enough, how much is appropriate. And now you've got legislators and judges, rather than editors, making those determinations. If we write legislation, especially at the federal level, that says, well, this much involvement in the newsroom is acceptable and appropriate, I can almost guarantee you that that standard will then find itself sometime, somewhere, in a libel case or in some other case not involving a shield law. And to me, that's the most significant danger about this.
New Jersey has a big media problem. As a state bookended by two of the largest media markets in the country, New York City and Philadelphia, New Jersey has never received from commercial broadcasting stations the kind of public affairs programming and local news coverage its residents need. And that was a big motivator, explains Dudley Burge, senior staff with the Communications Workers of America, for the creation of the New Jersey Network.
In the 50s and 60s, there was a lot of frustration amongst policymakers, state legislators, about not being able to get television coverage in New Jersey affairs in particular. So in 68, the Hughes Commission recommended that the state set up its own television network, and they recommended that the FCC licenses be owned by the state to make sure that there was actually New Jersey coverage.
NJN is one of only a few public broadcasters in the country that create a nightly news broadcast. But the governor, Chris Christie, has proposed cutting all state funding and privatizing the network. A legislative task force was established in July to review the governor's proposal.
The Jersey Network has historically been the only broadcaster that's covered the state as a whole, and it was really set up to do that. Governor Christie has proposed that state funding for New Jersey Network be ended and that be transferred to a nonprofit situation. And we think, certainly if you end the state funding, that that's probably going to mean they're not going to be able to produce any kind of quality news program with reporters.
Burge feels that the state funding is critical to sustaining the local journalism at NJN.
There's a lot of support for continuing New Jersey Network and continuing the funding. So what they did, in a sense, they kicked the can down the road. They're going to have a legislative hearing. You know, the legislature hasn't accepted the governor's program, hasn't rejected it. They're going to be looking at New Jersey Network, and I think the people on the committee are looking for a way to save it.
There will be hearings on the proposal September 14th, 16th, and 23rd throughout the state.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, this September 12, 2010. I first became familiar with our guest today, reading his work on the Internet sporadically in the middle of the last decade, and then as one of the judges for the Izzy Award, which is given to the Outstanding Independent Journalist. I was asked to read an entire dossier of Glenn Greenwald's work, and to put it mildly, I was astonished at its breadth, its depth, its quality, and its insight, originality, and brilliance. So he was awarded the very first Izzy Award, along with Amy Goodman, in 2009. And since then, I have been a regular reader of his work, and it is a great pleasure to welcome him to join us today on the program. Glenn, welcome aboard.
Great to be here. Thanks very much. Appreciate that.
Yeah, and Glenn, there's so much you've been writing about recently on your blog at salon.com, and I urge listeners to go to it if they're not familiar with it. And, of course, Glenn is the author. I should plug your books. I'm sorry about that, Glenn.
Sorry.
Of several books, most recently Great American Hypocrites, which came out in 2008. Do you have another book in the works?
I'm actually working on a couple books right now, but it'll probably be until 2011, the middle of next year, when it's published. So nothing to plug in that regard.
Okay, so just go to salon.com and get Great American Hypocrites. You'll be covered. I don't want to go in chronological order because I've been just going through your dossier for the last few months to pick out stuff, issues that I don't think are getting a lot of coverage in the rest of the media. And I think one of the things, Glenn Greenwald, that your work at Salon does and in general does, in addition to covering stories and pushing stories that aren't getting a lot of attention in the news media, you've become one of the best media critics in the business in terms of taking coverage of a story and using your research skills to highlight what's been missing, what's not being emphasized, what's fallen from view. And one of the stories I think that's been most extraordinary in how you've covered it and how it's been covered by others is the WikiLeaks story. And it came in and burst like a comet and then disappeared very quickly. And I wonder if you could just sort of talk about what you think is the significance of WikiLeaks and how it's been covered.
I think that WikiLeaks is the first genuine force that really scares people in power that has emerged in quite some time. And one of the reasons why they scare people in power, particularly people who rely upon keeping things secret, those at the Pentagon and in the intelligence community, it's because unlike, say, journalists, establishment journalists, WikiLeaks really can't be controlled in any way by the government. Even though you have situations where, say, the New York Times or the Washington Post will periodically disclose classified information, things that the government doesn't want disclosed, They work extensively with the government to ensure that things that the government really wants kept secret nonetheless remain secret. So, for example, when the Washington Post, Dana Priest, disclosed that the CIA was maintaining a network of CIA black sites where people were being disappeared beyond the reach of the Red Cross or any other monitoring, she, at the government's request, did not disclose which countries were the host of those prisons so that they could essentially continue. She essentially helped the government be able to continue keeping those prisons active by concealing which countries were hosting them. And when the New York Times disclosed that the NSA had been ordered by Bush to illegally eavesdrop on Americans, they withheld the story for a full year so that George Bush essentially was reelected without the American people knowing. WikiLeaks will not do that. They won't take orders from the government, they won't take directions from the government, and they won't withhold things that the government wants withheld unless there's an extremely compelling reason to do so. And then beyond that, WikiLeaks is a stateless organization. They really can't be found in any physical place, and therefore it's much harder to force them to divulge their sources or to use the threat of prosecution to keep them under control. And so WikiLeaks really represents a whole new way of uncovering government corruption and exposing government secrecy.
Well, what also was striking about the WikiLeaks exposure, the documents they released concerning the Afghanistan war, and the first thing that came to my mind was that why haven't our news media been uncovering all this stuff for us? Isn't that what we have a news media for? I mean, we're not talking, they weren't giving away the sort of secrets that, you know, were irrelevant. They were talking about core policies that, in theory, we're supposed to know as citizens.
Well, that was one of the interesting things about the reaction to the prior disclosure, the Afghanistan war documents, which is, on the one hand, there was this rush to say that what WikiLeaks had disclosed was really nothing interesting, nothing new. There was an effort to say that it wasn't the Pentagon Papers, on the level of the Pentagon Papers, because it was all kind of pedestrian knowledge that was sort of commonly understood. And yet at the same time, there was an effort to discredit them by saying that they had jeopardized national security with this disclosure, and obviously there's a great tension between those two claims. The reality is that a lot of the, most of what they disclosed was fairly low-level information, reports that were compiled by enlisted soldiers. This is not very high-level analysis the way the Pentagon Papers was. But because, as you just said, the media essentially ignores so much of what is reflected in these documents, it nonetheless is extremely valuable. You saw the same thing when the video was released of the Apache helicopter attack in Baghdad. Everybody knows in theory that we kill civilians in cold blood in the countries that we invade and occupy. And yet here was a video that had no secrets in it, legitimate secrets, but was nonetheless withheld by the government. The media did very little to cover it. The Washington Post actually had a copy of that video at one point and didn't disclose it. And so what WikiLeaks does, as you say, is it shines a light on things that people in the media know but very rarely actually talk about.
Julian Assange, and I think I've got the pronunciation correct, the head of WikiLeaks, took an enormous amount of abuse or criticism as a result of the leaking the government documents around Afghanistan, including, if I'm not mistaken, there were a series of charges against him that seemed incredulous on the face, on their surface. What was that all about?
Well, essentially the way that they tried to discredit WikiLeaks and Julian Assange and the entire operation was to claim that there were, among these documents that were disclosed, the names of various Afghans who had worked with the United States or with NATO in a cooperative way, and that by disclosing their names, there was no public interest advance, but that these individuals would now be endangered because the Taliban or al-Qaeda would target them, and that, quote-unquote, WikiLeaks had blood on its hands by not more carefully redacting these documents. Now, the reality was, you can make the argument, and I think it's a fair argument to make, that that WikiLeaks should have been more careful about going through these documents and withholding the names, although what came out is that it's fairly clear that they actually asked the Obama administration to provide some input into what information should be redacted, and the Obama administration refused to cooperate in any way with WikiLeaks, and it's very hard for WikiLeaks to know which names should be redacted, and they don't have the resources to go through 90,000 documents and do it. So the government had the chance, but what really happened there was it was pure fear-mongering of the kind that we see constantly when the government wants to discredit somebody. Admiral Mullen came out and Secretary Gates came out and used this blood-on-their-hands formulation to condemn WikiLeaks, and everybody rose up and said WikiLeaks, had been responsible for the deaths of innocent Afghans. And the reality is that not a single person has been harmed as a result of the release of the documents. Even the Pentagon acknowledges that there's no evidence whatsoever that anyone has been harmed. And it's just extraordinary to watch the same people, namely military officials and high-level government officials, who are responsible for the deaths of literally hundreds of thousands of innocent human beings, by virtue of all the things that we're doing in the Muslim world, all the aggression that we launch, suddenly find such concern for the welfare of innocent people in the Muslim world. It's clearly exploitative and exaggerated and just using fear to try and turn the public against WikiLeaks.
I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580 coming to you live today, September 12, 2010. Our guest, you're listening on the phone from Brazil, is Glenn Greenwald, the Salon.com blogger and columnist and author, someone who I hope you're familiar with. If you're not, after the show, I assume you will be. The number here, if you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Glenn Greenwald, is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Glenn Greenwald, you began as a constitutional lawyer and attorney and had a practice for many years. And a lot of your writing is on constitutional and legal issues. And I think that I can only speak for myself, but I think for a lot of people, the Obama administration, the Obama presidential campaign have been based upon a rejection of the policies regarding government secrecy and torture that the Bush administration had, and Obama had been quite critical of those policies. And this is in one area where people were hoping to see a great deal of change we could believe in. What, from your, and you know, you've been following this issue closely, how would you grade the Obama administration's record on issues of torture, secrecy, human rights, rendition, the sort of issues, the great issues of the Bush administration you cut your teeth on? How would you grade the Obama administration?
Well, I would take out torture from that list for two reasons. One is that by the time that Obama was inaugurated, the authorizations that had been issued by the Bush administration to use what they called enhanced interrogation techniques but were actually torture had been formally withdrawn. So we were not legally or actively torturing. I mean, we were never legally torturing. Torturing is illegal, but there was no legal authorization in place. So when Obama issued an executive order on the second day in office banning the use of these techniques, it had symbolic importance. It was a commendable thing to do. But the reality is it didn't change anything because those techniques were no longer being used by that point. But that's something that Obama supporters point to, I think, fair enough to say, well, that was an example of something that he did that was good in this realm, and it was. But outside of that, I would give him an F because – in virtually none of the other instances where Democrats and progressives and independents were screaming bloody murder during the Bush years over abuses of executive power, secrecy, and these radical assertions of presidential authority, has anything changed. And in fact, in some instances, it's actually gotten worse. And, you know, one of the interesting things is that for those of us who write about civil liberties regularly, we were saying these things almost immediately into the Obama administration. A month into the Obama administration, his Justice Department invoked the radical version of the state secrets doctrine that the Bush administration had used with, to such controversy, basically to block presidential lawbreaking from being scrutinized by courts. They told victims of torture and illegal surveillance, what we did was too secret, and therefore courts can't even look at anything that we did because to do so would be to jeopardize state secrets. And that was something that Obama criticized harshly, and yet in February, 1 month into his presidency, his Justice Department invoked that very claim to deny torture victims the ability to access our courts. And so those of us in the civil liberty world who had written about these issues so regularly started objecting and saying that he was being no different than Bush and violating his campaign pledges. And at that point, people were very reluctant to believe that Barack Obama would actually do the same things as George Bush did in this area, given how he campaigned, that he was a constitutional scholar, as he held himself out to be. And yet I think, you know, 18 months later or so, it's now so extreme and so blatant that it's basically common knowledge, it's conventional wisdom, that Obama is in fact continuing the vast, vast majority of policies that were considered radical and extremist in the Bush years and now are bipartisan consensus. Virtually nobody denies this any longer.
You know, I think there's pressure probably on some of the people who are sharp critics of the Bush administration when they engage in those practices, that they feel like if they go too loud against Obama, then they're just going to get the Republicans back and it'll even be worse than that. It seems like there's sort of a downward spiral logic there.
That definitely is, you know, even today, I mean, I hear even with the recognition that Obama has continued most of the Bush abuses and even, you know, exacerbated some of them beyond what Bush and Cheney did. That's definitely the objection that I hear the most, which is, well, you ought not to criticize Obama for doing these things, because what you do is you drag him down and you depress the Democratic base, and the Republicans are so extreme that you're risking a victory by the Republicans, and they're just going to be worse. And, you know, I think that our obligation as citizens and certainly as commentators is to provide checks on people in power, you know, when they abuse their power, to say so and to provide subjected to scrutiny. I think if you're an official at the Democratic National Committee, your goal ought to be to never say anything at all to hurt the Democratic Party. But I'm not a Democratic Party official. People who work on constitutional and civil liberties issues are not Democratic Party apparatchiks, and our obligation is to check abuses by people in power. And there are all kinds of abuses that the Obama administration is committing that all of us vocally objected to and condemned during the Bush years, and we would be horrible hypocrites and extremely intellectually dishonest if we refrained from criticizing Obama for doing the same things because we were concerned that it might hurt the Democratic Party if we say so.
You know, during the later half of the Bush second term, or during the second term in general, there was a small movement that never really got very far to impeach George W. Bush. And by the last year or two after the 2006 elections, the common refrain was, well, you know, he's about to go out of office, so sure, he's done all sorts of impeachable offenses, but, you know, let's just win the election in 2008 and move on. And no pun intended. And, you know, John Nichols, my frequent co-author who wrote a book on the genius of impeachment, made an argument that unless you enforce impeachment when it's done, whoever the next president is will assume they've got carte blanche to do the exact same, whatever party they're in.
Well, I think that view has been clearly vindicated. I mean, this is, you know, even a broader issue, and it's actually, you know, you asked me at the beginning if I'm working on a new book, and this is really what a big part of what my book is about, which is, you know, by essentially adopting a view that presidents are above the law and beyond accountability for things that they do in office, and that's clearly the view that we've adopted. I mean, not only did we refrain from impeaching George Bush when he was committing undertaking acts that we know for certain are illegal. I mean, not only is torture illegal, but we have a criminal statute in place for 30 years that says it's illegal to eavesdrop on Americans without the warrants required by law. And it imposes penalties of 10 years and 5 years in prison and a $10,000 fine for each offense. We know that he committed the law. Not only did we refrain from impeaching him, which is what the founders intended the solution to be, but, you know, presidents are not above the law, which means they are supposed to be criminally prosecuted when they break the law and commit crimes, and yet we have decided collectively that we're not going to prosecute the president or any of the people who work with him in committing these crimes. And what we do when we remove the president and the people who work for him from the rule of law is we incentivize lawbreaking. We essentially make it inevitable, because if there's no consequences for lawbreaking on the part of political leaders and the political class, then there's absolutely no reason why they won't commit crimes. And what you do is you essentially normalize criminality and ensure it continues. And as you say, because Bush had no consequences and did these things with impunity, Barack Obama is sitting in the Oval Office, and he has no reason to refrain from doing them as well.
Our guest today, you've just been listening to, is Glenn Greenwald, the blogger at Salon.com and author of many books, including Great American Hypocrites. He's joining us on the phone from Brazil. If you have a question or comment for Glenn Greenwald, the number here at Media Matters, WILLAM 580, is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Glenn Greenwald, how frequently do you write pieces for Salon?
I write essentially every day for them. It even sometimes, you know, is 6 days, 7 days a week. It's just sort of the nature of blogging, is that you just constantly pursue issues and write about issues of the day. So it's pretty much a daily basis.
Well, one of the things I really like about your blog and about your writing is you talk about issues that sort of get covered elsewhere, don't get a lot of attention, and usually don't get very interesting attention. Or sometimes the core truth is missed. And one of the areas I thought you really nailed well that should be a much bigger issue in our political discussion is this whole deficit commission that's going on to deal with the deficit, the bipartisan plan. And, you know, I think you rightly point out that when you hear these bipartisan commissions, you know, people should smell a rat.
Well, it's interesting, you know, this, I mean, I sort of analogize before, I would analogize it to what I said before, which is you know, in the civil liberties world, when we first started raising the red flag and sounding the alarm bell that Barack Obama was continuing many, even most of the abuses that made George Bush and Dick Cheney so radical, people just didn't believe it at first. You know, it was just hard to believe that given the conception that they had of who Barack Obama was, that he would actually do something like that. And there was a lot of resistance, no matter how compelling the facts were, to believing what was in front of people's face. And I think you're seeing exactly the same thing now with this deficit commission. I mean, there's zero question that the purpose of this deficit commission, one of the primary purposes, is to enable cuts in Social Security benefits. The consensus in Washington is that the biggest problem facing the United States is the vast deficit spending and debt that the country faces, largely because we gave huge tax cuts to the wealthy during the Bush years and because we have fought two extremely draining wars and all kinds of other covert military actions around the world for the last decade that we simply couldn't afford, and we've become a debtor nation. And the solution that Washington wants to embrace, one of the solutions, is to cut Social Security benefits and Medicare benefits and Medicaid as well. And, of course, the problem with doing that is that it's very politically difficult because Social Security is an extremely popular program, and for good reason. It's one of the very few guarantors that we have now in this country to a humane standard of living, to having the middle class remain the middle class, that there's some security in retirement. People don't want Social Security cut. And so the way that they've decided that this is going to get done, you know, nobody in Congress, certainly before an election, is going to take the lead, because if the Democrats do it, the Republicans will demagogue it. If the Republicans do it, the Democrats will demagogue it. And so they've set up this commission basically to, first of all, on a bipartisan basis, jointly recommend cuts to Social Security. And this deficit commission that the president set up is staffed with people who have a long history of advocating cuts in Social Security. So it's a foregone conclusion that they're going to recommend it. You can just look at who's on the commission and know that they believe that that needs to be done. And then what they're going to do is, instead of having a vote on it before an election so that the electorate can hold the people accountable who do it, they're going to issue the recommendations right after the election is over in December of 2010. And then the Congress is going to just vote yes or no on whether to enact the recommendations in an unchanged way. So nobody can make an amendment saying, I'm for this package, but I want to take out the Social Security cuts. It's either yes or no. And the idea is that the Republican and Democratic leadership will hold hands because there'll be enough in it for everyone. The Republicans will get Social Security cut. The Democrats will get that too, and they'll get some tax increases, marginal, modest tax increases. And that's the plan, and people will be extremely angry, but it'll be December 2010. There won't be an election for another 2 years, and that anger will vastly dissipate by the time anyone has to face the electorate again. And that's the plan. They're doing it all in secret. They meet in secret. There's no record of any or transcripts of their meetings. Just one day they're going to unveil their recommendations, and it's an open secret in Washington that one of the things they'll recommend is significant cuts in Social Security benefits.
How good of a job do you think our elite political media are doing of covering this issue?
You know, this is one of the things that I find actually to be among the biggest problems with the establishment media, which is, as I just said, it's an open secret in Washington that they're going to cut Social Security. If you talk to anybody in Washington who works in politics or in the media, who's at all tuned into the inside story about what's going on, everybody knows that that's what this commission is going to do. And yet they all play along with the pretense that we don't yet know what these recommendations are going to be, and that's because most people in the establishment media share the consensus that Social Security needs to be cut. These people in the establishment media aren't the ones who are petrified of what will happen in retirement. They don't need Social Security to have retirement security, because most of them are much wealthier than the average person. And so they are fully on board with the idea of cutting Social Security, and I think part of the consensus is that the only way it can be done is if the public isn't clued in to what this is really about until it's too late for them to do anything about it. And so I think there's kind of a conspiracy of silence, sort of pretending we don't know what this commission is going to do because we don't have access to the meetings and we don't know yet what their recommendations are, and so they play along with it.
Our guest, Glenn Greenwald. This is Bob McChesney on Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Our phone lines here are open at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Glenn Greenwald writes commonly, frequently, all the time for Salon.com and also is the author of many books, including Great American Hypocrites. More books coming the way, and the one you're writing now, Glenn, sounds fantastic. I can hardly wait to see it. Let's go to our phone lines right now where we've got a couple callers waiting patiently. Let's start with Line 2, Champaign County. You're on the air with Glenn Greenwald.
Hi. I really appreciate your work, and that was a great thing about Social Security. It's so worrying. But I wanted to ask you about the Goldberg variations. Your expose of, I find, and he's called you a cartoon character, and he doesn't need to respond to you, and he says that you had retracted one of your major leads that you pointed out that he will take both sides of an argument when it's works for him. And this is about the attack on Iraq, the attack on Iran. And I'd like for you to unpack that a little bit. And I also wanted to mention that the mainstream press has people that should be paid to look through the diary. So I don't think the Afghan diary, which is what they're calling WikiLeaks, there is a service called DiaryDig.org that's helpful to look through it. It's really inchoate stuff, and it's written in military ease, and that's not easy. So I just wanted to mention that there are people that are facilitating common citizens to see what's actually going on and what actually has been and is going to be revealed from WikiLeaks. So I'll hang up and listen, I guess.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And Glenn Greenwald, before you answer, I suspect most of our listeners have no idea what the Goldberg controversy is. If you give a little background, that'd be great.
Yeah, sure. It's interesting. I actually just finished an article for Harper's Magazine that'll be in the December issue about the fact that there's no accountability whatsoever in our established media, that people who make patently false statements as part of their journalism or punditry never end up in any way suffering not only a loss of their jobs or anything like that, but even a loss of their reputation or credibility or platform. And, of course, the best example are the people who lied to the country continuously and made what, in retrospect, are humiliatingly false statements in the run-up to the Iraq War. And one of the people who I've focused on who is most guilty of that is Jeffrey Goldberg, who at the time of the run-up to the Iraq War was the foreign policy correspondent at The New Yorker, where he wrote a series of articles essentially propagating the two big myths that led us into Iraq, one that Saddam Hussein had an active nuclear weapons program, and the second being that Saddam had an operational alliance with al-Qaeda, that he was essentially working with al-Qaeda. And, of course, both of those things turned out to be completely false. And if you look at the individual statements that Goldberg wrote at the time in 2002, there's one falsehood after the next that was, you know, sort of the byproduct of very reckless, if not intentionally misleading journalism. And not only has he not suffered any consequences, he was actually hired away from The New Yorker by The Atlantic magazine. They lavish all sorts of gifts on him and rewards. That's what happens in our culture. As long as you're pro-war, as long as you're supportive of wars, it doesn't matter how error-plagued you are, how embarrassing your record ends up being, you end up being promoted. And he's using his platform now, Jeffrey Goldberg is, at The Atlantic, to basically mainstream the idea of an attack on Iran. He just had a very widely discussed cover story in The Atlantic, essentially arguing that Israel is likely to attack Iran. And the question for the United States is, should we go ahead and do it instead, because it would be better if we did it. And I spent a lot of time in the last 6 weeks covering his horrific record of deceit and error, because the fact that we continue to take him seriously, I think, really underscores just how accountability-free establishment journalism is if you serve the people in power, as he does. And just on that last point that he made about WikiLeaks, I think, you know, one of the most interesting points that's raised by the caller's comment is that one of the best things about the Internet really is that you no longer need to rely upon what journalists tell you about things, like documents and letters and memos and the like, you can actually eliminate the middleman and go and read those things yourself. And there are databases online that allow people to just randomly read through the WikiLeaks documents and a whole variety of other documents that the media writes about. And I would really encourage people, when you have the time, to go to the source itself and read the original documents and not rely upon media summaries of it. It's amazing what you'll find is left out in media accounts or actively distorted.
Our guest, Glenn Greenwald. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Come to you live today, September 12, 2010. The phone lines are open at 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. You know, one of your beats that you cover really well, Glenn Greenwald, is the U.S. Supreme Court, and it periodically enters the news when there's a major decision or if there's an appointment to be made, a retirement. And the Obama administration has filled two seats so far on the court. And I just, you know, you've written at length about this, and I suspect many of our listeners haven't read your material or are not familiar with it. What is your take on the two Obama appointments, and what's your general take on where this court is at?
Well, I think the starting premise for understanding the Supreme Court is to realize just how right-wing this court is. You know, if you look at the four justices who are hardcore ideologues, they're so far to the right that, you know, it was at one point considered unconfirmable to be that far to the right. They're basically in Bob Bork territory, and he was, of course, rejected them. That's Thomas Scalia, Alito, and John Roberts. And the fifth vote is Anthony Kennedy, who was a Reagan appointee, who at the time when he was appointed and since has been a very conservative justice, and yet he's the quote-unquote moderate or swing vote, as Sandra Day O'Connor, another Reagan appointee, was, because the court is so far to the right that the justices, that if they just deviate a little bit, are suddenly moderate and swing votes. And so what you have is an extremely conservative court. And one of the things that people, I think, looked to President Obama to do, no matter how disappointing he was in other areas, was to fill the court with reliably progressive votes so that he could swing the court a little bit to the left, or at least, at the very worst, keep it the same. The one thing that, you know, you'd never thought Obama would do was actually move this already right-wing court even further to the right. So when he decided to replace Justice Souter, who was, although a Bush 41 appointee, but became part of the liberal wing of the court, such that there is a liberal wing, when he decided to replace him with Sonia Sotomayor, that was his first appointee, I was actually very supportive of that. And the reason I was supportive of that was because you could look at Sotomayor's record of 15 years on the federal bench. You can know what kind of justice she's going to be, that she would be a reliably progressive vote, and that she would not certainly would not move the court to the right. She was not going to be more conservative than Souter. And there was a chance that she could actually move the court to the left in some instances. And on top of that, when you look at what her story was, the fact that she grew up in genuine poverty and in the housing project of South Bronx, I had actually practiced in front of Sotomayor, so, you know, I know she's an extremely smart and hardworking judge. I thought it was a really good, solid pick, and I defended her from attacks by the New Republic and others, and defended the president. I thought that was a good pick. I don't think it's going to be a watershed, really moving the court to the left the way he could have, but I think it at least keeps the court the same. The last pick, I looked at the exact opposite way, because there, the person retiring was John Paul Stevens. And although he was appointed by a Republican president, by Gerald Ford, he probably is now the most liberal judge on the court. That's a sign of how conservative this court is, that a nominee appointed by Gerald Ford is, and really he was actually appointed by Nixon, but confirmed under Ford, has become the most liberal judge on the court. And my concern was that if you appoint somebody to replace Justice Stevens, who is not a reliable progressive voice, because they're more centrist than Justice Stevens is, or because you don't know enough about them and therefore can't be sure that what the effect is going to be, that you could actually end up moving the court to the right. Because what matters in terms of the impact of a judge, of an appointee, is not where they are on the political spectrum in some absolute sense. I mean, I don't think anyone thinks Elena Kagan is a conservative, per se, like Antonin Scalia. What matters, though, is where they fall on the spectrum relative to the judge that they're replacing, because if you're more conservative than the judge that you're replacing, you're going to move the court to the right, even though you yourself may not be a conservative judge. And I think there was some evidence in the record that Elena Kagan has some views that are definitely more conservative in the areas of executive power and some constitutional issues than John Paul Stevens that are likely to become before the court and will be very contentious. So I think there was some evidence that she could move the court to the right, but more so, she's such a blank slate. I mean, she's somebody who has essentially conducted her entire career over the last two decades by serving institutional power, by avoiding taking positions on controversial issues with some very rare exceptions, that it's just impossible to know what kind of judge she's going to be. And given how many superb choices Obama had to replace the person who became the liberal leader of the court, I thought it was a horrible pick to pick somebody about whom so little is known and for whom there's a real risk that the effect on the court could be a rightward swing.
For a long time, Glenn Greenwald, it seemed like the Supreme Court only came into popular political discussion when the issue was abortion rights and Roe v. Wade, and that the key thing was getting justices who would fall on whatever side of that issue one believed in, and that was going to be the key determinant for a Supreme Court justice, and a candidate you would vote for if you want to give you the justices you like. What are some of the other issues in the next 3, 5, 10 years that might come before the Supreme Court that this court will decide on of fundamental importance? I mean, what else do they do besides deliberate on matters of abortion rights?
Well, I think there's other social issues that the court is probably going to end up addressing, and the leading one of those is gay marriage, whether as Judge Walker in the Northern District of California recently ruled, it's unconstitutional to allow only opposite-sex couples but not same-sex couples the access to the institution of marriage and the legal benefits that it confers. And that's probably going to be as controversial as abortion. But I think, you know, the broader issues that are likely to have longer-lasting impact are in the areas of the power of the government. As we began by discussing, there were all kinds of novel theories invented during the Bush years about the president's authority to imprison people without charges, to impose a wall of secrecy around the illegal conduct that the CIA and other agencies engage in. The Obama administration has not only continued them, but now asserted the right even to assassinate American citizens without due process of any kind, and that's now the subject in the lower courts of a lawsuit on the part of one of the individuals who has been targeted by this assassination program. What we've really done over the past 10 years since the 9/11 attack is radically and fundamentally change the way our government works, change the power the president has, change the liberties that we always thought we enjoyed as citizens against the government. And a lot of those issues, the scope of legitimate power in terms of terrorism, are likely to become coming before the court, and they're not going to only affect the handful of individuals who are accused terrorists, but the nature of our government itself. What is the power of the government to use force to detain people in a broad array of cases? And I think that's, you know, the social issues get a lot of attention. They're often used to distract people and divide people. But I think those are the issues that are really going to have the greatest impact over the next several decades in terms of what kind of country we are.
Glenn Greenwald, before we go back to the phone lines here in Media Matters, I want to ask you about one other case that's gotten a lot of attention this in the past 9 months or so since it was announced, which is the Citizens United case. And for some of our listeners who might not be exactly familiar with it, could you please explain what that case was about and what you think the implications are going forward and what we can do about it?
Sure. There's been a long effort on the part of many people to try and do something about what is unquestionably the extremely destructive influence that corporate spending and spending by the wealthy have on our political system. I mean, it's, you know, if corporations with their vast resources and wealthy individuals are allowed to spend in an unlimited way What they can essentially do is drown out all other voices. They can buy elections. Mm-hmm. They can scare politicians into never opposing what they want, because if politicians oppose what they want, they're going to use their vast treasuries to defeat them. And, of course, that's been what's been happening. I mean, we essentially have a virtual oligarchy because corporations write our laws, their lobbyists dictate and shape the outcomes of legislative debates. And so there's been some modest efforts to try and rein some of this in. And one of those efforts is the campaign finance legislation that, for instance, limits what corporations can spend in the period leading up to an election. So corporations are free to spend as much as they want, except 60 days before an election, they're not allowed to spend from their general treasury. And it's not just corporations, but labor unions and other organizations as well. The problem, though, with that solution to what is clearly a terrible problem, is that the First Amendment guarantees the right of free expression, of free speech. And free speech, the court has held, applies not only to individuals but to groups as well. It applies to the ACLU, it applies to labor unions, and it applies to corporations. And so if the government says you can't spend your money on trying to influence an election 60 days before an election is held, that is a serious restriction on the ability of these entities to express their views, to say what they think is important, what kind of policies they think ought to be enacted. And so Citizens United was a case where a nonprofit group wanted to release a film that was critical of Hillary Clinton when Hillary Clinton was running for president, and the government said, no, you can't release that film because that would mean that you're spending money too close to an election in violation of the law. A very kind of classic limitation on free expression, and that group, Citizens United is their name, sued and recovered the Supreme Court by a 5-4 vote, said that this law that restricts the ability of corporations and other entities to spend money 60 days before an election does in fact violate the First Amendment, free speech rights of those individuals. You know, I'm somebody who actually thinks that the problem of unlimited corporate spending is one of the most significant, if not the most significant, problems that our political culture and political system face. Yet at the same time, I actually thought that ultimately the Citizens United case was probably rightly decided, because those are significant restrictions on free speech in a way that the First Amendment probably doesn't allow. And the reality is that corporate spending was already so extreme that I'm not actually convinced that Citizens United is going to make it all that worse.
But will it make it harder to enact reform legislation now?
I'm sorry?
Will that decision make it harder for Congress to come up with reform legislation, should it be so moved to do so?
Well, you know, it'll certainly make it harder to figure out how to limit corporate spending. I mean, the reality was Congress is not really limiting corporate spending in any meaningful way anyway. And part of the reason that they don't is because the reasons that I just mentioned, which is that they're afraid to stand up to corporations. So one of the things that they're trying to do, for example, to work way around this law, is to say, to pass legislation that will compel the disclosure of any money that's spent. So if corporations are spending, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars before an election, they have to publicly disclose it instead of hiding behind deceitfully named groups or funneling the money two other ways. That they can certainly do to require disclosure, although it hasn't passed the Congress. But what very well may be needed is some kind of a constitutional amendment to exempt large corporations from the free speech clause, at least in a way that allows some restraints to be imposed on the ability of corporations to drown out other voices.
Glenn Greenwald, could you do something? This has been suggested years ago, I haven't seen it recently, where you could let anyone give as much money as they want, but it would have to be entirely anonymous. It would go into a central office. Then you could say, I want to give $1 million to candidate X, and candidate X would get $1 million, but they wouldn't know where it came from. So you could give your money to support your candidate, but they wouldn't know they got it from you. And then that would mean you could lie to publicly. Say, yeah, I gave all these candidates money. They'd never know. So you could give your money, but there'd be no linkage between who gave the money and the politician, so they wouldn't know who they actually owed money to or who owed favors to.
Right. I mean, that's interesting. You know, it's hard for me to envision how you would prevent, for example, a large corporation from saying, you know, that $1 million you just got, that came from me. And, of course, you know, I could call up the next day and say, actually, no, it came from me.
Exactly.
But I think they're much more inclined to believe that it came from, you know, from Exxon Oil than from an average citizen.
But couldn't Epson's competitors say, hey, actually, no, it wasn't Epson. It was my oil company that gave it, and let Epson give them $1 million, and then you get the credit.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that you could, you know, you would say, make this donation on, you know, July 18th. And then July 18th, you see the $1 million credited to your bank account. You'd have a pretty good idea of who did it.
Well, you just go ahead, Glenn.
I think ultimately what needs to be done is the real solution to this problem. If you know, I think amending the Constitution is always dangerous, especially when it comes to the free speech clause. I think the real solution is public financing, a real public finance system, so that, you know, if one candidate gets $5 million from oil interests, their opponent will get matching funds from the government for $5 million. So there's no comparative advantage any longer to serving corporate interests because the government will ensure a limited playing field, an equal playing field, a level playing field when it comes to financial resources.
Our guest, Glenn Greenwald, you've been listening to today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, and I do apologize, listeners. I could talk to you, Glenn Greenwald, for 24 hours. We should do a Jerry Lewis telethon thing with you.
The questions are great. I've enjoyed it.
Well, I've only gone through like three of my 25 questions. We've only got 7 or 8 minutes left. We've got a couple callers waiting patiently. I do want to get to them. Let's start with line 4, New York City, I believe. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Glenn Greenwald.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. I've got two questions and comments, and I'll get to them quickly for you. First, Bob had on a couple weeks ago Dave Zirin, who talked about the fact that essentially pro sports teams have been bought up by billionaires and have become the toys of billionaires, by which they then exert, you know, public pressure to bilk money out of city governments. And my question to you is, do you feel as if basically in the wake of the problems that journalism and media outlets are having now supporting themselves, that basically billionaires are buying up news media outlets, such as Sid Harman buying up the Washington Post and Newsweek, and that Bloomberg now owns Businessweek, et cetera? Do you essentially see them becoming the toys of billionaires to use in exactly the same way, to essentially subvert you know, public policy? And my second question, it revolves around basically what we've heard from very recently from the Republican Party and what basically seems like ideological incoherence when you hear what Newt Gingrich is talking about, and supposedly people that are well-educated and do understand things. And so it's for that reason that people like Bruce Fein and Ted Olson, also certainly conservatives, have been able to, you know, distinguish themselves by actually being ideologically consistent. And Ted Olson's defense of, you know, same-sex marriage was as brilliant as you've ever heard, and, you know, cut through everything that Chris Wallace on Fox News could ever say. So it seems clear that they're being ideologically, you know, sort of false for reasons that we can understand. But my real question is, do you feel as if the Democrats are essentially doing the same thing in another way, and that we've essentially got like a good cop, bad cop scenario? And the reason why it seems like the Democrats are so ineffective and can't really get anything done is because, frankly, they don't want to. And that's not the point. And so, for example, when Austin Goolsbee made the comment during the campaign that, you know, Obama says about NAFTA, don't worry about that, he's just saying it, nothing will happen. And as you've heard, you know, a political gaffe is sometimes described as accidentally telling the truth. I wonder if that points to, or if you think that that points to the fact that, you know, and I don't mean to brush all Democrats across the same way. I certainly wouldn't expect someone like the senator from Wisconsin,
Russ Feingold,
to all of a sudden switch over to the Republican Party because he was facing a difficult challenge in the election. I know there are some that are certainly ideologically consistent, but do you feel like what's going on and the reason why liberals are sort of so frustrated with Democrats fully in control is because, frankly, they're just sort of playing that good cop, bad cop game? So I'd like to hear your comments on this.
Thank you very much, caller. Glenn Greenwald?
Yeah, those are two good, really good questions. You know, I think the issue of billionaire control over the media is really not new. You look at the media outlets that are the most influential. I mean, of course, you know, NBC and MSNBC are owned by General Electric, and for a long time, CBS is owned by Westinghouse and Viacom now, and, of course, Fox News and News Corp. I mean, these large institutions are all controlled by extremely wealthy people. I think there's a big problem with, you know, billionaires buying offices. Michael Bloomberg is definitely looking at the presidency, run for the presidency in 2012. If the economy is bad, I think he clearly intends to do that.
Which party? Would he run as an independent, do you think?
Yeah, as an independent and sort of run, you know, as a sort of better manager of the economy than Obama and a less crazy, you know, sort of conservative than the Republicans on foreign policy and kind of a moderate on social issues. I think that's where he thinks is the sweet spot, and the fact that he has $4 billion to spend, you know, will immediately make him viable. You see that with all kinds of candidates in this cycle who are spending their own fortunes to buy offices. But I think that there is a solution. I think the Internet has really equalized the playing field because you can find large audiences without very much money being spent at all. And so I think, you know, this is a complicated topic, but I do think that technology has really equalized things in a way that I'm much more optimistic about than I would be in its absence. And you know, as far as the second question and the Democrats are concerned, I think it gets back to what we were just discussing, which is there are factions in Washington that have nothing to do with the political parties that are permanently in control. You have the Pentagon and the intelligence community, and you have, you know, the banks and corporate interests. And no political party can really provoke the anger and hostility of these factions without paying a very significant price. You know, and the Democrats' place in the way they win elections is by churning out rhetoric about representing the ordinary American. Of course, the Republicans do that too. But the reason, you know, there's such populist anger being exploited by the right is because the Democratic Party is reliant upon corporate interests. Wall Street is who funded the Obama campaign and Democrats. I mean, he had a lot of small funders as well, but huge amounts of corporate money and Wall Street money went into electing Barack Obama, and so the Democratic Party is very cognizant of where their bread is buttered.
Glenn Greenwald, we've only got a little over a minute left, and our last caller, we don't have time to get her on the line, but I've got a summary of her question, which is she's concerned that commentators like you and myself and some of the guests in the program have been overly critical of the Obama administration, not recognized all the good things that they've done. Without necessarily dealing with that comment, are there aspects of the Obama administration, what they've done, that have been pleasant surprises to you? Are there things that you think worthy of commendation?
I think there's some symbolic things that are important. You know, they've changed the way they talk to and about the Muslim world. I think Obama's comments this week and a month ago about the mosque, the community center near Ground Zero, where it was, you know, pretty impressive, even inspirational. I think that they've tried to at least rein in Wall Street a little bit, tried to expand healthcare access to people. But mostly what they've done is entrench the system and the way that Washington works and not change it. And so I think the central pledge of the Obama presidency has been violated.
One last thing. As I read your work, Glenn Greenwald, I can't help but at times think, you know, you don't have a very optimistic view of where this country's going for the visible future. Am I right or am I wrong? I mean, what do you sense is the fate of this country in the coming years?
I think the country is clearly on the road that prior hubristic empires have traveled down, which is extending their reach far beyond what their limits are, and that the only inevitable outcome is to be severely weakened in numerous ways, financially, militarily, more vulnerable. And, you know, I think, though, that anybody who does what you do and what I do, which is regularly participate in public debates, deep down believes that there's some cause for optimism, that through rational discourse, the citizenry can become convinced of the need for the proper action to take and that proper action can have beneficial effects. And so although I think that things have gone very, very awry.
Glenn, I think I better close you off on that wonderful note because I hear the band tuning up in the background. They want to clear me out of the studio. Glenn Greenwald, thank you so much for joining us today on Media Matters.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
All right. Now I want to thank Melissa Trentz, my producer, Kyle Kroha, the engineer. I'm Bob McChesney. Thank you all. I'll be back in 1 week, everyone. Have a great week.